Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. This is your host, Jackson Hogan, here with one of the legends of our sport, a man immediately identified by just two tidy initials, CB. He set a world record in speed skiing in 1963, going 106.89 miles per hour on regular downhill gear at Portillo, Chile. I'll talk to CB about setting the record, of course, but there's another big topic on the table, the creation of a spectacularly successful clothing brand bearing his name, with four factories and hundreds of employees. We'll get to his business success in a bit, but first, let's talk skiing with my revered guest, Mr. CB Vaughn Jr. CB, welcome to RealSkiers.com.
Well, hi, Jackson, and it's great to be with you today and sort of hopefully share some of my past experiences and look forward also to getting to know you.
Oh, great. Well, let's take where both of our paths as skiers began, which is in southern Vermont. My parents' second home and later first home in Peru, Vermont, not far from Manchester, Vermont, down valley. We were up by the mountain at Bromley Mountain. How old were you when your family moved to Manchester?
Jackson, we moved to Manchester when I was 6 or 7 years old from New Jersey, and my dad and mom had had enough of, I think, the suburbia life and decided to buy a home in southern Vermont. They bought a farm and became farmers for a long, long time. There wasn't much else to do in Vermont. If you didn't ski, you didn't really do anything in the winter.
That's absolutely true. Between Peru and Manchester was an inn called Johnny Seesaw's, which wasn't founded by my godfather, Bill Parrish, but he bought it from the founder. I would sometimes ski off the pushover trail at Bromley and be able to bushwhack down to either our home itself in Peru or get my way over to Johnny Seesaw's.
Johnny Seesaw's and Bill Parrish were very famous people in the southern Vermont area. Not only did they build a great business, but Bill Parrish was a tremendous individual.
Bill Parrish was, like me, a Yale graduate who got into the ski business. He, little known fact in the U.S., he was the first importer of Dinastar. He was the first importer of Reichli. But he had to get out of the ski hard goods business when letters of credit got too big and it would have jeopardized the financial security of the inn. So he ended up getting out of the ski business. But he was part of the reason that I also was entranced with skiing, because here I was, this little snot-nosed kid, and he would race me. And at this time, we had shorties, and Bill Parrish was a great advocate of short skis, which he would literally take an old Japanese Amori ski, a ski of no particular distinction, and saw them in two, and take the front bit and put a binding on it, and you had a shorty. He was a great experimenter.
Right.
He was also, I think, the first president of SIA.
Well, I didn't know that. Well, yeah, that's wonderful.
He was actually head of SIA, so he was deeply embedded in the ski business and had a lot of friends in it. Let's skip over to the mountain. I remember the main drag, Big Boulevard or something like that, Upper Boulevard, and that segued to a run right under the lift called Twister. And I used to race my friend and neighbor, Deb Bradford, side by side. We would get in our little tucks and race straight down the front of Bromley. And I remember one time we were just rocketing along and some poor soul pushed off right in front of me. So I had to throw a 90-degree turn in at my max speed, which tore all the screws out of one of my skis. And we had long thongs at the time. So all I could do was hold that ski off the snow while it sort of quietly rotated itself around my foot. And since it was unmoored now from the ski, until the tip caught the snow behind me and just threw me on the ground. So I had some experience with speed skiing at your home mountain of Bromley, but not always with your legendary results. How did you, without a race program, get into racing at Bromley Mountain?
Great question. Really, in Vermont, as a youngster, there wasn't much else to do but to learn to ski. And there was a great ski school director called Neil Robinson, who was there when I sort of started to learn to ski. I had an opportunity at a very early age to be able to begin ski racing. And everybody at Bromley was very supportive of youngsters that wanted to get involved in ski racing. And I felt that it was something that was exciting for me, enjoyable. And I look back at it, and really the first major race of my racing career that I won was the Orvis Cup, at Bromley that went from the upper twister that then was called the Upper Boulevard all the way to the bottom of the mountain. Yeah, it was just a great part of my life and had so many friends locally that sort of supported me. I ended up staying in the Manchester area for 1 year of high school at Burne Burton, but I wasn't the best student in the world, and my parents decided that I should go away to prep school. I ended up interviewing at Holderness and Kimball Union Academy and Proctor Academy that were all tremendous schools and had great ski programs, but ended up going right back to Vermont to a little school called Vermont Academy in Saxon River. At that time, Warren Shivers, a Nordic coach, really had very little experience in developing alpine ski racers.
Before we get off the subject of Bromley and Neil Robinson, a name that opened a file, the headline of the file would say, Neil Robinson, he was the ski school director who ran off with the owner's second wife. If you remember, Neil absconded with Fred Pabst Jr.'s Sally Pabst, ran off with
Sally Pabst, who was a great woman, yes.
Also, I remember Neil Robinson because he was back in a period, dear listeners, when ski school directors were a big deal. They were important. They had national prominence. He had a Brill Cream ad in like Time magazine. I mean, who is that Brill Cream man? It's Neil Robinson, you know, director of the ski school at Bromley, or Big Bromley, excuse me, Vermont, not to be mistaken for Little Bromley across the street, which was nothing but a Puma lift. So anyway, just so I'd share a little background of the name Neil Robinson before we return to your program, and you're off at Vermont Academy, and you're going to segue from there to St. Lawrence. Now, presumably, you're going to do more dedicated racing while at St. Lawrence.
Yes, I really wanted to go to Dartmouth and Middlebury simply because they had a lot of Olympic skiers and were really known for their ski racing, where St. Lawrence in upstate New York was really known for its hockey. And yet they had two very famous skiers, Dave Jacobs, who started a company called Spider, but Dave was also the Olympic Canadian ski team coach. And I felt that knowing Dave, that at least it was an opportunity to be able to continue my ski racing career, even though there wasn't much of a ski hill in Canton, New York, where St. Lawrence was located.
Did you race all events in college? I mean, how did you race downhill at St. Lawrence?
Yeah, no, actually, I was a four-event skier because at Vermont Academy, where obviously our coach was an Olympic ski coach and Olympic cross-country runner, and I really enjoyed skiing four events. And at that time in my career, I wasn't really focused on wanting to become an Olympic skier, although I certainly felt that it was something that I had the ability of becoming. So my dedication to ski racing really started at Vermont Academy, but it didn't really continue to develop until I got to St. Lawrence. And then obviously I had the opportunity of competing everywhere in the United States at a very high level. And that really led me to knowing that when I got out of college, that I certainly wanted to be in the sports and recreation business.
When did you first go really fast? When did you get that particular bug? Because you don't know it at the time, but you're going to set a world record in speed skiing in the not too distant future. How did you cultivate handle speed?
I was lucky enough to be able to spend 3 summers in Portillo, Chile, where obviously the seasons are reversed from the United States. So their winters are our summers here. And that really gave me the opportunity to develop my ski racing career. An Olympic ski coach for the Austrian ski team called Ottmar Schneider in the Hotel Portillo. And for some reason, he and I really hit it off extremely well. And it wasn't really because of my ski racing capabilities, but he was a tremendous individual and really formulated the beginning of my ski racing career when he put me over on a beginner ski hill for the first month that I was in Portillo. Would come over every 3 or 4 days to see how I was doing. And literally it was a true beginner's hill and really frustrating, but it probably was the most important thing of my ski racing development, because even though I felt I was a relatively good ski racer. I really wasn't, and I had to learn all about sort of technique and the desire to become a winner. And Otmar really instilled that into me, not only as a ski racer, but as a human being, that winning is something that once you sort of have the taste of it, becomes contagious.
So you're going to Portillo three consecutive summers. Which of those summers did you set the record? Help me understand, help my listeners understand, a context which is very different from the context we have today.
The fourth year that I was there was really in a year of Olympic tryouts for the U.S. ski team. And so I felt that downhill training would be really important for me. And so therefore, I didn't spend any time to speak of in slalom and giant slalom training. And I went over where they were building this incredible speed track and said, well, this is probably the best thing in the world for me to do, to see how fast we could go, but how much I could learn. And I knew that everybody in South America who was a ski racer knew that Ralph Miller, who was on the U.S. Olympic team going to Dartmouth College, had the world speed record. And when we started downhill training, we really never thought about trying to set a world's record. It was just getting comfortable at speeds of 80, 90, 100 miles an hour. And then all of a sudden, one day, we said, well, gee, we're going over 100. We think that we could go 107, 8, 9, or 10. And that really started it. It was a couple of weeks of training, of packing the hill, boot packing it. Actually, the Chilean army was very supportive on sending up a lot of their soldiers to boot pack the hill so that we could get it as firm and as hard as possible. And then each day of training, we would go a little bit higher. And then once we were going 100 miles an hour, we said we might as well go all the way to the top. And Dick Dorworth was with me, great individual who was also a very fine ski racer, and we set the world's record together.
That's an absolutely amazing aspect of it, and we'll get that to how you came down to that 106.89, both of you together. But getting back to the competition itself, so it was really a specific event, if I can make an analogy, be more like an Evel Knievel Canyon jump than it would be like a competition where we send out invitations around the world and people come from all over to compete with one another. And
definitely, it was more of a training experience, at least in my eyes, what I felt I could get over if I had any fear, and I'm not sure that I did, but racing, I probably never been more than 70 or 80 miles an hour. So now all of a sudden to go to 100 miles an hour, you know, that was a big jump psychologically, mentally, just to get comfortable at high speeds. The sad thing is that there were people that did fall, that did get hurt, and yet that never really enters your mind because you're very positive about saying, first of all, you're physically really fit. Mentally, you feel that you're prepared to compete at the highest level.
How specialized was your equipment? Today, if you were to try to set a speed record, you'd have fairings on your legs and you'd have an exotic helmet that has no other purpose in mankind other than this. How specialized was what you were skiing on?
Actually, Howard Head was the head ski company all through my ski racing career, was very generous with supplying me with what I felt were really the best skis in the world. That's what I used. And they were the same skis that I would be using in downhill ski racing, except they were a little bit longer. Howard, as you're probably aware, in the head ski company, you know, he was a tremendous creator, first of all, and a very, very big supporter of ski racing, just not in the United States, but through the European ski nations also.
Right. Howard was a great supporter of the sport. He was really a model of someone how to build a company and do it right.
Yeah, an incredible human being that contributed so much to our world of recreation.
Yeah, people may have forgotten, dear listeners, but he also created the Prince racket, which was the first
without a doubt
tennis racket, which I'm sure made him a lot more money than his ski business ever did. Let's talk about your partner in crime here. Dick Dorworth is a name not known to a lot of skiers. He's better known in the climbing universe. He's revered, I think, as a rock climber. He is also revered by yours truly because he is a fantastic writer, and he's a fantastic comic writer. he wrote a piece for some sort of a rag. We had a lot more magazines back in the ski industry then, and he wrote for one of them a piece about a product called the Lynx. Not too different, in fact, from my godfather Bill Parrish's shorty skis. The Lynx had no tail at all. And then what they called the third edge, which was the back of the ski, it was originally called the Scorpion. No matter what you called it, it was absolute garbage. And Dorworth wrote this hysterical skewering, absolutely making sure that if you ever bought one of these things, you would realize that what a worthless human being you were and how you did not understand anything about skiing, because there was no parallels really between going around on this truncated piece of junk and actual skiing. Anyway, any Dorworth stories? What comes top of mind about Dick?
Well, Dick obviously is a tremendously creative individual, was a great athlete and still is a great athlete. And I think that climbing became incredibly important to him, as also did creating magic with his writing, and has an enormous following, and I believe has written 3 or 4 books already. We spent a tremendous amount of time together, obviously in South America, in Portillo, and got to know him very, very well. And yet I didn't know him that well, because I didn't realize he had as much creative talent as he did when he decided that there were other things other than just being a ski racer. The Purcell family that owns the Hotel Portillo were so supportive and such marvelous people, and got to know their guests fairly intimately. And in those days, the hotel only took like about 400 or 450 people. And yet down in the catacombs below, they probably had 200 or 300 people that were the workers in the hotel and also the workers out on the ski slopes, because other than importing some of the Chilean army people to help out, the whole ski preparation at that time was also done by the hotel workers. And then Otmar Schneider was such an ice hockey fan, and God knows where that started from, as being the director of the ski school. But then the hockey rink became incredibly important, and ice skating. There were individual hockey teams that were started amongst the hotel guests because they had skates that weren't the best or the sharpest in the world, but they had lots of skates and hockey sticks. So behind the hotel, there was a rink that was used by a lot of the hotel guests.
Going back to the actual event, if we can call it that, of the speed record, did you and Dick ever talk about doing a tiebreaker right after you realized that both of you, who set the record first, who set it second, and there was ever even talk about trying to break it?
Well, I was the first one down the hill and Dick was the next one down the hill. I guess that whoever the timing people were, and nothing was ever said about it, but yeah, we had the exact time. I think that that was okay. It probably was the exact time, but who knows?
Did you make a nickel out of the speed record?
No, not at all. What it did is it just opened up a lot of doors for me when I came back to the United States. It wasn't really a big deal, but I think in the state of Vermont, it was big because Vermont at that time was known for ski racing and Billy Kidd. And it certainly, I think, helped me when I launched CB Sports to have not having a world's record, but to have a bona fide ski racing career that certainly people in Vermont might have followed. When I went out with my first CB Sports line to knock on some doors, it certainly, I think, helped open some doors. It just that you were a young kid and you didn't know anything about the apparel business. And I guess you knew a little bit about ski racing, but in college, I was a physical education major, and I started in business, but because I was on the road so much, my business professor said, "We think that you should pursue another major in college." So the academics of it. But luckily enough, when I got out of college, I met the chairman of the board of AMF, which is a very large company that happened to own the head ski company. The Gott family was very instrumental in helping me transcend from my athletic experience into the world of business. And I was there for 2 or 3 years. And then all of a sudden decided that I wasn't cut out for corporate America. And that was really what decided me to launch CB Sports.
Before we get off to CB Sports, which I definitely want to talk about, I just wanted to add that I remember you and Dick doing a victory lap at Bromley after you had both set the record. When you come back to North America, I can distinctly remember watching you two come down the mountain. You were making turns. You were trying to set a speed record so that there was some sort of spillover and notoriety more or less directly after you set the speed record. But I would have to say for most skiers, when you and Dick set the record, it was the first time anybody had heard of a skiing speed record. Maybe Cognoscenti knew about those that preceded you. But to me, your victory was like a clap of thunder that came after a long silence. I didn't know anybody had been even doing this stuff. And lo and behold, we have not one but two world speed record holders. One of the other characters, aside from Dick, that you and I both know, and I claim a deep respect for, is Sven Coomer.
Oh, without a doubt.
What role did Sven play in your life?
Well, he was a wonderful individual, and I got to know him more when I lived around the Newport Beach, California area, where Sven was from, and he was still very involved in his consulting business and ski boots and ski boot design. And we would spend a fair amount of time just sort of reminiscing about the ski industry. I was reminiscing about my ski racing career. And Sven was obviously very involved in making sure that ski boot design, both from the standpoint of design, but more from the standpoint of performance, was something that was near and dear to his heart. He really created what I think was really the beginning of the ski boot revolution in ski boot fitting and buckle alignment and inner linings and inner soles and soles of ski boots, really became one of the world's, I think, best known boot designers.
He should have been, because he is responsible for the only two surviving archetypes of ski boots that we have. I'm happy to say to your listeners that we're actually seeing some forward motion in both classic three-piece and two-piece shell designs coming up in new products that you'll see this fall. But those wheels all began turning with a guy named Sven Coomer, because without him, you don't have either of those designs.
That's right.
He created them both. You also created something absolutely remarkable. We can come back and talk about Sven more if you'd like, but I want to get on to creation of CB Sports. Talk about a meteoric rise. You began by selling ski pants out of your car, not the most glamorous launch pad. Talk about the origins and how that segued to a huge business with multiple factories in more than one state and hundreds of employees.
It was really because of the 2 or 3 years that I spent in corporate America, not feeling that I found a place where I could use whatever creativity I had. I wasn't aware that I had a lot, but Mr. Gott sent me to California to work with the Voigt Rubber Company in Santa Ana, and they were the largest producer of swim fins and basketballs in the United States. Somehow, we got convinced that we could take our basketball technology of how we would wind the bladder of a basketball before it would be molded. We felt that we could take that technology and develop a ski. So we developed the Voigt ski with a very tremendous engineer by the name of Freddie Pirin, who came from the Head Ski Company. And I spent a couple of years doing that in California and just really burned out on the California lifestyle. Decided to leave the company. It was a difficult decision because I was offered an opportunity to go and work for Howard Head, and yet that was Timonium, Maryland, and I really missed Vermont and sort of the seasonal changes and the people there. So I moved back to Vermont not knowing what I was going to do, and I had some other job interviews that weren't extremely exciting for me. And so I woke up one day and said, gee, I have this incredible ski racing career. I have a part of a world speed ski record. I'm going to start a ski apparel company. And that one day woke up and asked a couple of my friends if they would be interested in participating with me or investing with me. And they said, CB, we'd rather give you the money than be a partner with you. And that led me to going to a little local bank. I think I had 50 grand in my bank account from some of my ski racing career. And I found a bank that was willing enough to give me some money and said, CB, we think it's a great idea. Best of luck and go do it.
Didn't you also get some early support from Governor Snelling of Vermont?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the state of Vermont, Dick Snelling and Barbara Snelling, Dick's wife, the state of Vermont was really instrumental in, excuse me, okay, in any real success that we had was because of support along the way from the Snelling family and a lot of other great Vermonters who were there. Because I really knew nothing about the apparel industry and nothing about sewing or manufacturing. And so it was a learning process that I had to get up to speed. And I knew that I was going to make mistakes. And everybody else probably knew I would make mistakes. But along the way, we had incredible support. And maybe it was just the time that young entrepreneurs had the opportunity to go out and venture out and build a business. It's much, much different today, as you're aware.
I think one of the differences, and you and I have spoke about this before, is that today, if you try to put together a clothing company as undercapitalized as you were, the banking community would just give you the collective Heisman and say, John, think of something else to do because we're not loaning you any money.
Yeah, without a doubt. Go out and get a real job instead of trying to be not a hero, but trying to develop a business. So times are so difficult for young people, and that's why I'm in the midst of, I really want to write a book to share with people about how you can build a brand, what it takes, and really excited about that we can talk about later.
One of the things I want to talk about is why CB Sports Clothing hit such a perfect chord, a perfect note for the ski community. I'll expand on that thought for a second. If you look at today's modern ski wear, it is ghastly, ill-fitting, ugly, and colors, I don't know where they picked them from. And your stuff was beautiful. People wanted it. It was stylish. And most importantly, you didn't have to wear it skiing. It spoke of skiing. It said, I'm a skier. It was a badge you could wear to high school or to work. And people would say, hey, that's cool. That's more than just a coat. This is an emblem. It belongs to something cool, which is this sport of skiing. And you captured all that. If you look at the ski wear that then was produced 20 years later, Nevica onesies and Descent suits that look like you're a bellman at some Park Avenue apartment complex. Just ghastly stuff. You wear those to school, you get beaten up and left in the trash disposal. What you did was not just come across with good quality clothing at a fair price. You came up with something that captured the zeitgeist. How on earth did you do that?
I just think that through my whole ski racing career, I was lucky enough to find a couple of tailors in Austria that I could pass on my ideas to. And I was never really very fashionable, but I always knew that there was an opportunity from my ski racing career of looking what ski racers were wearing to say, I've got to believe I can create something that's more exciting, not just for skiers, but for athletes in general. And that's where I started out, was knowing that I wanted not to fit every physique in the world, but I was very much aware that for people that wanted style, they also wanted something that would fit and be functional.
It wasn't just functionality. Pardon me for stepping on your line. It wasn't just functionality that drove the bus. People had pride in this. It wasn't just pride. Look, it's waterproof. That wasn't it. It was, look what I got. It was excitement like a kid on Christmas morning. I just spoke recently with Greg Stump, who told me that when he was growing up as a freestyle skier, he was so excited when he got his first CB Sports stretch pants and outfit, because now he was the real deal. And he paid full retail for it. This is before he'd won anything. You really, I think, touched on a way of belonging by wearing your stuff. You were like in a big, great club of people who got it. Was that conscious?
Well, yeah, I think all along, my AMF or my experience in corporate America was that you better be unique if you want to be successful in building a brand. You've got to have something that draws people to say, I'd like to be part of that experience in that respect, or what it represents. And I think that all along the way in the development of CB Sports, I was always cognizant of trying to make sure that wherever we could, we would help people and get our product on the, not just trend centers, but people that were contributing something to our society. Obviously, for me, that started with athletes, but, you know, it was participating in whatever I could do to help people through my CB Sports apparel. I was going to do that.
I think you succeeded nobly. Didn't CB Sports sponsor the Patriots? Don't I remember the sideline wear at the New England Patriots football team? Didn't somebody cleverly get them under contract to CB Sports?
Well, the first NFL team that we outfitted, but the coaches and the quarterbacks and the wide receivers, the W.L. Gore Company, Bob and Bill Gore, were nice enough to offer me a fair amount of Gore-Tex fabric to make sure that I got it on what they called trendsetters. And the trendsetters for me at that time, because they played all their games outdoors at that time, was the NFL. And then also being able to outfit the U.S. Olympic hockey team and the bobsled team. And I always felt from my athletic background that it was important to try to give athletes a psychological edge. And I always felt that if they look great, they'd participate great.
Reminds me of the old Billy Crystal line, if you look marvelous, you feel marvelous.
Yes, without a doubt.
So what you did was really capture lightning in a bottle. I think you and I would both agree that if your story began today, it wouldn't end the same way. You wouldn't have the state support. Who knows whether you'd be able to build out to 4 factories in today's crazy labor unions-riven market.
Right.
And I think some of the charm of running and owning and successfully championing your brand eventually eroded under the drearier part of owning businesses.
Well, it ended up, as we continued to grow at a fairly rapid rate, I got to spend less and less of my time being creative, even though I was still approve every design and literally almost created every design for the company. I had a design team or an R&D team of probably 20 or 25 people that basically for the first 6 months of every year, they had the freedom to do whatever they'd want to do. And then in the beginning of the 7th month, it was, I hate to say it, but you know, I was really the quarterback and it was time for me to make all the decisions. And it was something that I cherished and that I enjoyed, that I felt that what I learned from other companies in my corporate experience was there were really too many contributors and not enough leaders in that respect of people that were willing to sort of lay it on the line and take the risk necessary to be different in that respect. And I guess that was a lesson that I learned early on, that in building a team, you have your 50 or 90 athletes with you, but you really have to have the Super Bowl quarterback who takes it upon their shoulders to make sure that all the players in each position are performing to their maximum. You build a great company by having tremendous dedicated employees, but you know they have to also have good leadership.
Eventually, you accept an offer from Calvin Klein. Talk a little bit about the denouement.
I tried to do a reverse merger into a public company and bet literally $10 million of retained earnings, which was a lot in those days, to have a successful merger, ended up failing, and I retained Merrill Lynch to become our investment banker. And because CB Sports was fairly well known at that time, there were a lot of potential suitors. And I probably should have done a little bit more research and not relied on much on Merrill Lynch as I did. And I ended up selling it to a consortium group of Calvin Klein players. And really, as soon as you're aware you're south of having controlling interest of a company, you're really relegated to the sidelines. Although I didn't have to be, but I just felt that the new owners didn't really have a sense or a feeling of those 1,000 dealers that really made the brand. It wasn't CB Sports that made the brand. It were all the customers and the contributors along the way. And they felt that they didn't really need those 1,000 ski retailers that they could do it with Bloomingdale's, Saks, Lord & Taylor's, and major department stores. And as soon as that was the decision, I said, thank you very much. I'm gone.
What a tragedy, ladies and gentlemen, only because there was a great symbiotic relationship between the specialty market back then, which is very different from the specialty market of today.
Yes.
And brands like CB Sports, there was a real sense of not just partnership, which is sort of business talk for, you know, we're doing business together, but a real recognition that you were both in the same boat pulling on parallel oars. And it was a very close and a much more caring relationship than what you normally see in the business world today, where everything seems to be dispensable. Nobody thought CB Sports was dispensable. It was a cornerstone of the stores that carried it. You had many, many accounts with $500,000 commitments to you. It's for a ski shop.
Yes, without a doubt. A
lot of coin.
We had 10 retailers that bought over $1 million a year from CB Sports. Yet the small little dealer who would buy 20 or 30,000 was just as important to me, because ultimately they could become the big guy if they decided that's what they wanted to be.
We don't need to go into all the ways the market has changed, unfortunately, in the intervening years. That's a topic for future podcasts, dear listeners. You are Charles Bird Vaughn Jr.
Yes.
Did you ever feel that there was some burden or onus of success that was on your shoulders, of an expectation because you were a junior?
Junior? No, not at all.
Okay.
No. My dad and mom, and I was an older child. My sister is 10 years older than I am, and so I don't know whether I was a mistake when I came or not, but my parents were never really involved. They were interested, but you know, they came from a different generation, and corporate America is where you belong and get a job. And what are you doing out there trying to build a business or a brand or something? And I love them to death, but there wasn't a lot of interest. Even though they lived in Vermont, they certainly respected skiing and what it did for their country inn that they had. I think in their mind, I was cut out to be in corporate America. And I'd always say, Dad and Mom, but I can be corporate America with my little company.
If you follow up by investing in Ben & Jerry's early in their career and worked at the ice cream side of the U.S. business world very successfully for 10 years, that period is apparently fading into the background. And you're now living in New Mexico with six dogs, which occasionally run across the back of the screen behind you.
Right.
What's life in New Mexico like?
Living in New Mexico, I fell in love with a wonderful gal in Southern California. I said to the love of my life, you know, why don't I call Ben & Jerry's and talk to him a little bit about, could we put some Ben & Jerry's scoop shops on the beach cities in Southern California? And lo and behold, they were going through being acquired. We were having lunch in Seal Beach, and there was a Cold Stone Creamy ice cream store right from where we were having lunch. And I said, Sharon, why don't we buy that store? And that's how the Cold Stone started. Sharon bought two Cold Stones, of which I wasn't really involved with other than doing some of the financial work. And Sharon built two incredible Cold Stone businesses that allowed her to sell them and move to New Mexico.
Last point. Last time we spoke, you said you're doing some designing now. What are you working on? You reviving CB Sports?
Well, yeah, no, I'm still obviously really excited about what isn't happening in the world of ski and snowboarding. Yeah, I'm continuing to doodle and draw and draft and think about building a brand again. I think that there's a tremendous opportunity. And I think that I have some exciting design talent to continue to create, and we'll see where it all goes.
Well, I'm sure I'm joined by millions of American skiers saying we are so grateful to have had CB Vaughn in our lives. You are revered in this sport, CB, and you should know that. You are a deeply loved individual. And I want to thank you for spending your time with us today on Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. CB Vaughn Jr., ladies and gentlemen, an American legend.
Thank you very much, Jackson. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to you, CB, and thanks to all my dear listeners at Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Thanks for listening.